Well, since the feast, I've listened to several messages, and I've not just re-listened to the local ones. I've gone around and listened to many others from various sites, and I'm always encouraged that God's Spirit works in so many different people in similar ways. And all across the country and around the world, we read the same Bible, and we all bring something slightly different away. We may be one in spirit and one in unity. We still understand different things will jump out off the pages at us in different ways, and that's God's Spirit working, and I'm appreciative of that. In one of the messages I've listened to recently, a comment was made that sparked this message, and I was reminded that there is a lot of power in questions. Questions have a lot of power, and there are a lot of questions in the Bible. In the English language, there are four types of speech and writing. We talk about writing in sentences, these four different types of speech. Those would be declarative, exclamatory, imperative, and interrogatory. In other words, they end with a question mark. By the way, it's ringing up here a little bit. I don't know if that means anything. There are over 3,000 questions in the Bible, and Jesus Christ is recorded as asking over 300. And no, I didn't count them all. The number is not important to me. The concept is intriguing, though. The Bible, knowing who it's written by, isn't just a book of imperative statements. Indeed, it has lots of commands. There are lots of thou shalts and thou shalt nots. But there's a mixture of these other forms of communication with very few exclamatory areas of the Bible. Questions are one of the ways we communicate with each other, and used well, a question is a good teaching tool. Questions are a way to understand if the person you're talking to, whether they're getting what you're saying. Like, you could lecture your husband or your wife or your kids or your neighbors or your children or your students. That doesn't mean they're getting it. But if you ask them a question, if you ask them to give it back to you, then you start to understand whether they understand. So God gives us his words in the Bible, and we can read them, and we all come away with varying degrees of understanding. And we can aid in this process by asking the who, what, when, why, where type questions, and it helps us go deeper and take these questions and lead us to a better place and to a better understanding. Now, we don't need to question when we read the Bible. You don't need to question and say, I wonder if this is right or not. I wonder whether God's telling me the truth. I would hope that we all agree that the Bible is the truth. And if there's an error somewhere, it's because man has put the punctuation in the wrong spot or done something messed up with it. Whether we fully understand what we're reading is the challenge. And that's where we can ask God to show me. What am I supposed to be learning by this particular thing? Interestingly, Jesus Christ, when you go through and study his questions, he did not ask when questions. And that's interesting. He answered a lot of questions in a lot of different ways, but he didn't ask when questions. But in our prayers, many times we want to know, God, when are you going to give me a mate? When are you going to give me a house? When are you, please give this thing to me, and can I write it on my calendar? And that's not the way God works. We like knowing a time frame because life is short. We want to know, should I eat dessert first? And that's not necessarily the way God answers questions. So there are great questions in life. Maybe when you were coming into the church, the question, does God exist, was important to you. Or what happens after death tends to come to the forefront every so often. Dr. Ward, for those of you who have ever listened to his sermons and been a part of his class, he had the seven great questions in life. And the two main sections were, who is God, what is God, and what is his purpose? And who is man, and what is his purpose? And so the Bible supplies the answers to these questions. So the Bible asks many questions, but it answers many questions. And we have to take the time to read and understand it. I forgot to start my clock again. How am I supposed to know how long I'm talking? Anyway, I'd like to think for a minute about some of the great questions in the Bible. Let's start with the first questions in the Bible. The first question recorded in the Bible, if you think about it for a minute, was from the serpent. And he said, has God indeed said, you shall not eat of every tree of the garden? Well, this he said to the woman with the intent to undermine and discredit God, to plant doubt in her mind. Well, that's kind of what we would expect the devil to do, or the serpent to do. And the second question came from God. And God said in Genesis 3:9, where are you? Speaking to Adam, I don't know how he said it, but that's what was said. And it wasn't a game of hide and seek. God asked the question, and he wanted an answer, but God knew where Adam was. But he asked the question to draw Adam out, to see what Adam would say or do, and to, again, God knew the answer before he asked it. And the third question was, who told you that you were naked? And it goes on. And I asked the question, why would Adam have, what would have changed between the time before they'd eaten the fruit till after they'd eaten the fruit? Something changed. And so suddenly what was just fine before they ate the forbidden fruit, suddenly after that, something changed, and Adam knew he was naked. Something changed. God already knew what the problem was, and Adam may not have known exactly what the problem was and why he suddenly felt afraid and needed to cover up, but that's what he did. That's what the way he felt. And God said, have you eaten of the tree I told you not to? So God knew the answer, but would Adam admit that he had done wrong? God knew the answers before he asked the question, and that's interesting. And it's a little disconcerting because God knows the answers to questions he asks us before we even answer. So why ask the question then? Why didn't he just lay into them and say, you know, you ate of the forbidden fruit. You sinned. You're banned from the garden. Bad dog, out. But that's not the way God asked questions. He did it in his way. He, as it were, made them feel small. He presented the obvious. He kind of rubs their noses in it. They knew they were wrong. God doesn't seem to be angry when he does this. God was smart. God knew they were going to do it anyway. He's declarative. He said, you did it, here's the consequence. You did it, you're now banned from the garden. The next notable question is, am I my brother's keeper? Well, that's another interesting question, because why would Cain, Cain had a guilty conscience. He knew what he had done. First off, he lies, and then he answers a question that was kind of like this, out of the abundance of the heart, the mouth speaks. So God asked him a simple question, like, where's your brother? And all of a sudden, it's like, boom, the whole thing kind of doesn't go up in smoke. It's He blurts out, like, again, he lies, and then he asks, am I my brother's keeper? And you know, God could have said, how do you really feel about your brother? Well, I hate him. I killed him. But that's not what Cain said. He asked, and the questions produce the answers, the real answers. So questions are very powerful and thought-provoking. Questions are very powerful and thought-provoking. Let's go to the book of Job. There's a lot of questions in Job. We're not going to go through those, at least not all of them. But I do want to note a couple things. Job 1 and verse 6. So Job 1, 6, you know, Job is, and his family is down here on earth with all their stuff and doing their partying and having a good old time. And up in heaven, it's a completely different scene. Up in heaven, God is quizzing Satan. That's hard for me to wrap my mind around. Of course, God's smart, and Job needs to learn some things, and God's the one that needs to do it. God's going to help him do that. Job 1 and verse 6, now there was a day when the sons of God came to present themselves before the Lord. Again, interesting activities that we don't normally think about as we run around down here. And Satan also came among them, and the Lord said to Satan, from where do you come? So Satan answered the Lord, from going to and fro on the earth and from walking back and forth on it. In other words, he was out looking for trouble. And when God brought up Job, Satan was right there ready to slay Job. Then the Lord said to Satan, have you considered my servant Job, that there is none like him on the earth, a blameless and upright man, one who fears God and shuns evil? So Satan answered the Lord and said, does God fear Job? Does Job fear God for nothing? Have you not made a hedge around him, around his household, and around all that he has on every side? You have blessed the work of his hands, and his possessions have increased in the land. But now stretch out your hand and touch all that he has, and he will curse you to your face. So Satan's whole emphasis was to get Job to fail and prove that Job wasn't as good as he appeared to be. You'll find that God questions us to make us better, and Satan questions us to get us to trip and fall. It's obvious in these two, in the examples that I've used so far, that there is an antagonist in the world who is not looking out for your best interests. He does not love you, and it does not want to see you succeed. And he influences our thoughts and our actions as many times as he can, and he uses his questions to devalue God, to deceive you, and to plant doubt. Oh, maybe God's way isn't the right way. Maybe there is some other way of doing this. Verse 12, and the Lord said to Satan, behold, all that he has is in your power, only do not lay a hand on his person. So God allows this to play out. He doesn't tell Satan what to do. So Satan went out from the presence of the Lord and devised his plan. So Job 1 and verse 20, this is after Job was stripped of all his earthly possessions, not all of them, but his family and his stuff was basically wiped out. And Job arose in verse 20, tore his robe and shaved his head and fell to the ground and worshipped. And he said, naked I came from my mother's womb, and naked shall I return there. The Lord gave and the Lord has taken away. Blessed be the name of the Lord. In all this, Job did not sin nor charge God with wrong. And that is an admirable statement and a sentence on its own right, but it just went to show that God did understand, God did know his heart, and God knew what that Job was an upright man. So Job 2 in verse 1, again, there, another day that sons of God came to present themselves before the Lord, and Satan came among them also to present himself before the Lord. And the Lord said to Satan, "Where do you come from? From where do you come?" I wonder if I'm dyslexic. Satan answered the Lord and said, "From going to and fro on the earth and from walking back and forth on it, looking for trouble." I also add words to the text. Then the Lord said to Satan, "Have you considered my servant Job, that there is none like him on earth, a blameless and upright man, one who fears the Lord and shuns evil? And still he holds fast to his integrity, although you incited me against him to destroy him without cause." So God says Satan's intent was to destroy Job, and Job persisted and did it correctly. So goes verse 4, "So Satan answered the Lord and said, 'Skin for skin, yes, all that a man has he will give for his life, but stretch out your hand now and touch his bone and his flesh, and he will surely curse you to your face.' And the Lord said to Satan, 'Behold, he is in your hand, but spare his life.' So Satan went out from the presence of the Lord and struck Job with painful boils from the sole of his foot to the crown of his head. Then his wife, Mrs. Job, said to them, 'Do you still hold fast to your integrity? Curse God and die.' But he said to her, 'You speak as one of the foolish women speaks. Shall we indeed accept good from God, and shall we not accept adversity?' In all this, Job did not sin with his lips." So he was a man of integrity. And as the event progresses, Job asks a lot of questions. Chapter and his friends ask lots of questions, and they're trying to find the answers. They much pontification, much human reasoning, much going on and trying to dig and figure and try it from different angles. These guys were Job's friends, and I'm actually have always been kind of impressed that they stuck by him, even though they weren't really helpful. They did stand by him for what it was worth. So as it goes on and on, God finally takes his turn in Job 38:1. I'm talking about questions. I'm talking about answers. So Job 38, verse 1, "Then the Lord answered Job out of the whirlwind." God answers questions in strange places. He's in the cloud, he's in the fire, he's in the whirlwind. So God's all over. "So the Lord answered Job out of the whirlwind and said, 'Who is this that darkens counsel by words without knowledge? Now prepare yourself like a man. I will question you, and you shall answer me.'" So I'm going to see what's in your heart and see how you're going to respond to this. And then here we go. "Where were you when I laid the foundations of the earth?" So God is supplying an answer. Job didn't really care about the foundations of the earth. He just wanted his life and his stuff and his boils to go away. "So where were you when I laid the foundation of the earth? Tell me if you have understanding. Who determined the measurements?" Well, God did. "Surely you know. Or who stretched out the line upon it?" God did. "To what were its foundations fastened?" Well, God knows. "Or who laid its cornerstone when the morning stars sang together and the sons of God shouted for joy?" Well, God did. These are all implied answers. Job, I was here long before you were. Then this continues. "Where were you when I?" Where were you when I? So God was there first. So you go through chapter 38, 39, 40, and Job gets in a couple verses there. Then God takes off again in chapter 41, and it concludes in chapter 42. To me, God's answers here are very important and insightful. He clarifies that he is taking care of all the small things we rarely even begin to think about. And God is I just haven't ever sat around and worried about Leviathan and how I could get a hold of his tongue. And as you read through these, you're like, wow, God's thinking about something this small or minuscule, like, well, who tells the goats on the mountain to when to have a calf, or like things that are completely off our radar. It seems like a small thing, but it comes out in God's answers to Job. God is being figurative, maybe, and there are lots of questions that are real. There are things that make a difference. God could have shortened all these chapters to say something declarative like, Job, I'm God, and there's none like me. So there. But that's not the way God answers. God doesn't seem to give people a straight answer. And that can be quite frustrating, you might have noticed by now in your life. You might say, God, quit beating around the bush. Give me a straight answer. Can you just tell me what I'm supposed to do? Can you just put this person in my life? Can you just provide this answer? Can you just heal my sickness? But God doesn't do it that way. Maybe you as a person did this when you've experienced it when you were young and you're having some tussle with your parents and they're like, give me a straight answer. Or maybe your kids, like you say, did you make this mess? They're like, give me a straight answer. But that's not the way God works. We like straight answers. So the communication is the part of the process that helps us understand God. So we're asking questions, and God might be giving us answers, but it might not come in the form that we expect. When we do this, like you're talking to friends, we ask a lot of questions. Like, how did your week go? What about this? What about how's your foot? All these types of questions, and it helps us understand each other, and we get to know each other better. But as some of us have children in our houses, children, grandchildren, or children of various, maybe you work in a school, you can use these questions as teaching tools to those children. You know, it says in Romans 1:20, for since the creation of the world, his invisible attributes are clearly seen, being understood by the things that were made. And so you can ask your children, like, where did this flower come from? How come when I drop this ball, it falls to the ground? But this balloon that I'm holding, when I let it go, it goes up. But other balloons fall to the ground when you let them go. And make the child... Don't just tell the child every little thing. Make them think about why. Like, how does this happen? And in the process, they learn about science. They learn about God. They learn about the things that you would normally just figure out on your own. You know, it was mentioned last week that Jesus Christ spoke in parables, and Jesus spoke lots of parables for many good reasons. Jesus Christ was smart, I would say. But he asked 305 questions, according to the one author. So he asked something over 300 questions, and many of them being how and why questions. So he's trying to get into people's heads and get them to talk and express what's really in their heart. It made them think. So I was using a website called redletterchallenge.com, pretty simple, redletterchallenge.com, and the writer was Zach Zender, and he's the one that came up with the 305 questions, and if you go to his site, if you want to read the questions, there are 305 of them listed at the end. It's not the questions that he actually writes up, it's the way they're presented and what Christ, again, knows the motive. He knows what the people are thinking. And so he's got an advantage on them, and he can ask a question, the perfect question, to get them to respond in a certain way. So this website broke Jesus' questions down into four categories. Curiosity questions, these are Jesus' questions, all right? These are the ones that he's just focused on Jesus Christ questions. Jesus asked curiosity questions, open-ended questions, challenging questions, and his fourth one, he makes a kind of a big deal out of. Jesus Christ never asked when questions. He never asked when questions, and that's very interesting that when it had to do with timing, Jesus always pointed to the Father and said, "You know, Father knows when these things are going to." Not even the Son knew when they were going to be. So it's the interesting thing is how God frames the perfect question for each situation, for each person. Let's turn to Luke 2. We'll look at a couple here. Luke 2 and verse 47. So this is, they're returning home as Jesus is 12 years old. He's returning home from the Passover in Jerusalem with the family. Jesus doesn't get in the same cart, same wagon, whatever, with his parents, and they just assume he's running around with one of the cousins. And in Luke 2 and verse 45, it says, "So when they did not find him, they returned to Jerusalem seeking him. And so it was after 3 days they found him in the temple, sitting in the midst of the teachers," notice what he was doing, "both listening to them and asking them questions. And all who heard him were astonished at his understanding and answers. So when they," his parents, "saw him, they were amazed, and his mother said to him, 'Son, why have you done this to us? Look, your father and I have sought you anxiously.'" And his question to his mother, he said to them, "Why did you seek me?" Pretty brave for a lost child. "Do you not know that I must be about my father's business?" So he asked his own parents a pretty straight question that they probably set them back. The questions that he was asking would not have been childish questions. He didn't ask them, "What color is your shirt?" He was asking them things that could easily have been asking them things that they could not possibly have understood, like the origin of man or things. Remember, he wrote the book, so anything they ask, he already knew. He asked questions with stories and more questions. Luke 7, verse 42. Luke 7. And every situation was slightly different. It's not like he had a curveball and he always threw a curveball. He would ask these questions and just put the people, make them uncomfortable. He just dumbfounded them. So he had techniques that worked. So Luke 7, verse 36, "Then one of the Pharisees asked him to eat with him. And he went to the Pharisee's house and sat down to eat. And behold, a woman in the city who was a sinner, when she saw that Jesus sat at the table in the Pharisee's house, brought an alabaster flask of fragrant oil and stood at his feet behind him weeping. And she began to wash his feet with her tears and wiped them with the hair of her head. And she kissed his feet and anointed them with the fragrant oil." Verse 39, "Now when the Pharisee who had invited him saw this, he spoke to himself. He didn't say it out loud, saying, this man, if he was a prophet, would know who and what manner of woman this is that was touching him. Remember, Christ knows the guy's thoughts. For she is a sinner. And Jesus answered and said to him, remember, he didn't ask the question out loud. Christ said to him, Simon, I have something to say to you. And so he said, teachers, say it. In verse 41, there was a certain creditor who had two debtors. One owed 500 denarii and another 50. And when they had nothing with which to repay, he freely forgave both of them. He forgave them both. Tell me, therefore, which of them will love him more? And Simon answered and said, I suppose the one who forgave more. And he said to him, you have rightly judged. And he turned to the woman. He turned to the woman and said to Simon, do you see this woman? I entered your house. You gave me no water for my feet, but she has washed my feet with her tears and wiped them with the hair of her head. You gave me no kiss, but this woman has not ceased to kiss my feet since the time I came in. You did not anoint my head with oil, but this woman has anointed my feet with fragrant oil. Therefore I say to you, her sins, which are many, are forgiven, for she loved much. But to whom little is forgiven, the same loves little. Well, he's just frying the Pharisee here. And he said to her, your sins are forgiven. Your sins are forgiven. Doesn't say anything to the Pharisee. And those who sat at the table with him began to say to themselves, who is this who even forgives sin? Then he said to the woman, your faith has saved you. Go in peace. So Jesus knew the heart, and he was able to cut a deep swath in their, like in the Pharisee's ego with his questions. He didn't have to preach to him. He asked him a simple question, and it just would have been a dumbfounding moment. Mark, let's go to Mark 12 and verse 13. Mark 12. Mark 12, verse 13. Then they sent to him some of the Pharisees and the Herodians to catch him in his words. Well, they're messing with the wrong guy here. They're not going to catch him in his words. And when they had come, they said to him, teacher, we know you are true. So this is hard to read because he's buttering them up, and they're trying to butter him up and catch him in his words. And so we know you are true and care about no one, for you do not regard the person of men, but teach the way of God in truth. Is it lawful to pay taxes to Caesar or not? Shall we pay or shall we not pay? So they're trying to get him to make this answer, and then whichever way he answers, they'll go to the other side. But he, knowing their hypocrisy, said to them, why do you test me? Bring me a denarius that I may see it. So they brought it, and he said to them, whose image and inscription is this? And they said to him, Caesar's. Notice their questions. Jesus is asking questions as they go. It's over and over again. He doesn't just preach to them. He asks them questions. Jesus answered and said to them, render to Caesar the things that are Caesar's, and to God the things that are God or God's. And they marveled at him. So he would dumbfound them with his questions. Again, he knew the heart of all he dealt with. And they were all at a distinct disadvantage. There's no way they were going to win messing with the Son of God, trying to catch him. Now, in our lives, we aren't going to be able to match Christ's genius or wisdom or insight. That doesn't mean we shouldn't try to grow in our ability to understand what's going on around us and discern the spirit and the attitude and the intents of what's going on around us. And again, we don't have to just be declarative to our children and just preach to them. We can ask them questions and to people, you know, people on the street, if you get in a conversation with them, you don't have to just say, you know, the Sabbath day is the seventh day and it's pagan and like Sunday's pagan, and you don't have to go at it from that way. You can learn from the way Jesus talked to people, and you can ask them questions to get them thinking and to kind of rattle their cage. Stephen Covey, in his book, Seven Habits of Highly Effective People, had a phrase that is well known. He said, "Seek first to understand and then to be understood." Well, Jesus understood already what was the people that he was confronting or dealing with. Jesus knew his audience, but they didn't necessarily understand him. But it's our job. We do need to seek to understand. We need to understand who we're talking to in the situations that people might be in before we just start laying on the advice. So asking careful questions can help us understand, and we don't necessarily have to be declarative and be telling them the way it should be done. We can come alongside them and ask questions and understand where they're coming from. So many times we want God to respond to us on our terms. We want God to make us feel better or take away our problems or heal our injuries or sicknesses, whatever, and you know, make our life good and comfortable, and that's not necessarily the way God works. Philippians 4 is a scripture that is, I don't know, I'll call it disconcerting, because it talks about how God answers questions. Philippians 4, and we'll start in verse 4. Philippians 4, verse 4 says, "Rejoice in the Lord always. Again, I say rejoice." It's repeated for emphasis. So in the midst of questions and concerns, the directive is to rejoice. How do you handle your tough situations? Well, you're supposed to rejoice. So verse 5, "Let your gentleness be known to all men. The Lord is at hand." Verse 6, "Be anxious for nothing, but in everything by prayer and supplication, with thanksgiving." So again, it's like you wouldn't be anxious for nothing if there wasn't something to be anxious for. "Be anxious for nothing, but in everything by prayer and supplication, with thanksgiving." Okay, so like it's kind of a setup here. "Let your request be made known to God." That's our job. Let God know what's going on. "Let your request be made." And verse 7, "And the peace of God, which surpasses all understanding, will guard your heart and minds through Christ Jesus." So we are supposed to present our case to God, and that's supposed to bring us peace. Because the peace of God, which surpasses all understanding, it doesn't necessarily feel like it fits together, but God is saying, present your case and get on with your life, and have peace in the situation. Like, you've given it to God, right? "God, here's my problem. Okay, now get on with your life." And that's hard. Let God work out the details. And so the very next verse, "Finally, brethren, whatever things are true and whatever things are noble, whatever things are just and whatever things are pure, whatever things are lovely, whatever things are of good report, if there's any virtue and if there's anything praiseworthy, meditate on those things, not on the troubles that you presented to God." That's an interesting again, God's telling you, God didn't say it's going to be easy. Verse 9, the things which you have learned and received and heard and saw in me, these do, and the peace of God will be with you. The peace of God will be with you. So there are things that we are supposed to do and things that God is going to do. So we put our request before God. We're not to be anxious. It doesn't say it's going to be easy, but it's necessary. It's necessary that we present to God, and it's necessary that we move on and that we have peace in the process. Sometimes if God gave us the answer, that wouldn't solve it. The answer, maybe we don't need the answer. Maybe it would tip our scale if we knew what was going to happen, or that maybe you weren't going to be healed, or maybe this situation wasn't going to work out. God says, I'll give you peace, not necessarily answers. You know, God says in Isaiah that my thoughts are greater than your thoughts. We can't possibly think that we're going to outthink God. We can certainly pray about it. We can break our prayers down fine. God says, trust in the Lord. Trust me. I have your best interest in mind. Don't lean on your own understanding. Acknowledge me. I'll direct your paths. But I'm not, God doesn't say I'm not going to give you every answer, but he says, give it to me and you're going to have peace, and then get on with your life. Even in Daniel 12, God had shown Daniel many things about the end times, and God didn't answer his questions. God said, go your way. You wouldn't understand it if I told you. And so he shut up the book and sent Daniel on his way. So we need to do our job and let God work out the details. Without fussing and hand-wringing and worrying about pacing back and forth and other forms of anxiety, God, we ask the questions and we wait for God to give the answers. And we have peace in the process of waiting. We don't need perfect understanding to obey God. We just don't. We need to trust that God knows what he's doing, that it's going to work out. We need to obey to the extent that we understand, whatever that is. If you know a little bit, then you need to do that. If you know a lot, then you should do that. So, but in the process, we're going to grow. We're going to get to know God, and we're going to wrestle with God, and we're going to take our problems to him and go back and forth and again, we can have peace knowing that God's in control, and that it's going to work out all right. You know, most of us know that God gives one of three answers, or maybe a mix of them, but the yes, no's, or wait, or not now. God can answer in different ways, and reminder that Jesus prayed, if it's possible, let this cup pass from me, and God said no. And so God doesn't always give, even his beloved son, he doesn't always give him the easy answer or the answer that you might prefer. So questions can be used as a weapon. It can be used to bully people or to mock people or to make people feel small. You can cut people down. You can put people down. You can put their ideas down by the way you ask questions and drill them. But questions, when presented in a spirit of love and asked correctly, can make a person think and consider and inquire about their inner feelings. And again, if you're raising children, using the question more instead of the declaration and the preaching can help them learn about God better. Interrogative conversation will draw more out of the young minds, and teaching them about God by going over points of nature and how come the birds are able to fly, the geese were flying over last night, and it's just amazing. They're all in formation. Why did they just happen? They have a committee and get together and decide, okay, when we fly, we're going to do this or that. Like, God just made them that way. And if you read the latter chapters of Job, he talks about things like that. So in talking to your friends, you don't want to be lectured. So questions make a conversation interesting and informative. And you don't come to church and then just find somebody and start telling them everything you did this week. If you do, they'll probably walk off on you. But by interactive questions and back and forth, we are able to get to know one another and learn about one another. And as we read Scripture, take the time to meditate. When you come across 3,000 questions in the Bible, think about what was behind those questions. Why were they asked? What was the purpose? Did it get the response that you would expect? Was there a different form of communication that would have worked better? You know, ask the who, what, why questions and try to gain insight into Jesus' mind. Questions make us think, even when we don't want to. Great questions make us look within ourselves for why we think or feel the way we do. And it's just, it's an interesting genre, maybe is not the right word, but if we never ask the hard questions of ourselves, we are likely to miss out on growth opportunities. So there is a lot of power in a question. And when a person asks us a question about our church or about beliefs and all these types of things, God will give you the answer you need. 1 Peter 3:15, He'll give you that answer. He'll help you express yourself. So this works both ways. People ask us a question, we need to be able to give an answer that satisfies them. So when you read the Bible, think about the questions others have asked. Think about your own questions. Think about God's questions. Each of them are revealing, and each of them come at this the whole concept from different angles, and you're able to learn things from the different types of questions and the different ways they're set up. Jesus asked a lot of questions, careful, thoughtful questions. We must be careful to ask the right questions of God. And you don't ask God questions to put him down or to make him feel like, or you know, you're not implying that God's making a mistake. You're trying to, and you're not questioning his authority. You're trying to understand the way he thinks and his timing and his intent. And so that it's important that we ask respectfully and with a desire to learn and be willing to accept the answers as they come back. So questions can be good when done with respect and a desire to understand. Jesus Christ was great with questions. You can read his words and think about his questions and try to understand them. Think about what went into the backstory behind the questions. Think about why the Pharisees would have tried to do these. You know, they were always trying to get under Jesus' skin, and it never worked. So use questions to gain insight into your life and to better understand the people around you.